This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Welcome to the future of grocery shopping. Food delivered to your doorstep in a self-driving car.
Barbara Adams just used her phone to summon the self-driving future.
Toyota showed a concept vehicle earlier this year at CES that envisioned a Pizza Hut delivering its pizzas to you fresh at the door, maybe even being made in the vehicle.
Autonomous vehicle developers, the tech companies and the car makers are teaming up to sell us again a utopian future.
Peter Norton is a historian in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. As he surveys the media landscape, he's seeing a glimpse of one possible future and practically a scene-for-scene remake of the past. The salesmanship behind autonomous cars, he says, harkens to the earliest Detroit strategy of cultivating discontent with the mere status quo. In 1929, auto tycoon Charles Kettering actually preached, quote, "Keep the consumer dissatisfied," and consumer marketing has heeded him ever after.
The transportation planning that predominates today arose during the era when public relations was being invented. And it was being invented because it was starting to look like people had all the stuff they wanted. So you had to convince people that they had needs they didn't know were needs, like, say, bad breath.
Try Listerine, buy Listerine, keep breath fresh and clean with Listerine.
You had to convince them that they needed shampoo, which they didn't use before. And you had to convince people that they needed to be able to drive anywhere, anytime, without delay, and have a free parking spot when they arrived. None of those needs were needs that began as demands from ordinary people. All of those needs were sold to people, and they were sold with really amazing showmanship.
The GM sales pitch had perhaps its grandest moment in 1939. At the same time that liberal democracy itself seemed to be crumbling around the globe, the sprawling utopian Futurama exhibit demonstrated to World's Fair visitors the promise of fancy new roads.
New horizons. Roads for men to go places.
The city of 1960, 20 years in the future, was presented as a driving utopia where everybody could go everywhere by car without delay and park for free when they got there.
And now we see an enlarged section of 1960s express motorway. Along the ledge of this beautiful precipice, traffic moves at unreduced rates of speed. On all express city thoroughfares, the rights of way have been so rooted as to displace outmoded business sections and undesirable slum areas whenever possible. Man continually strives to replace the old with the new.
Futurama wasn't intended to be a rigorous exercise in urban planning, but it also made no attempt to even acknowledge negative ramifications of a future motor America. In other words, it was an ad, a 35,000 square foot ad.
They were selling us ideas about how our lives would be built around cars.
Emily Badger covers urban policy for the New York Times.
And so it's not in their interest to think very hard about what the unintended consequences of that would be. You know, to think about congestion, to think about sprawl and consuming agriculture land to build exurbs, how these highways would lead to the economic decline of a lot of downtowns, that these highways would need to be built somewhere, and in many cases we would choose to build them through minority communities and cities. You know, none of that was part of the Futurama vision.
Penetrating new horizons in the spirit of individual enterprise. In the great American way.
And did the USA ever buy in?
Is that you in that beautiful car?
Power steering.
Driving too fast!
What are you trying to do to me, you crazy little car?
Because American culture is car culture, and it goes beyond our commutes, our thrills, our conspicuous consumption, and our family road trips. In October, IKEA, as in the furniture chain, published survey data showing that of 22,000 people polled, about 45%, quote, go to their car outside of the home to have a private moment to themselves. Cars are our emblems, yes, but also, after our bedrooms and bathrooms, our third favorite, sanctuaries. That sort of integration into American life suggests a sort of end of history, the immutability of the personal car, or cars, in America's driveways till kingdom come. Except, maybe not. Just as there was a lot of 20th century money riding on universal auto ownership, there are 21st century Silicon Valley fortunes on Futurama 2.0, the wide adoption of ride-sharing and driverless cars. We cease to be drivers, only passengers.
You know, what would the business model for a car service that takes you around look like? Does it look like in exchange for getting a ride to work, you have to sit there and stare at ads? I don't know, I get in a car and I'm sort of having like a virtual shoe shopping experience on my commute. And if I do opt to buy a pair of shoes, then I no longer have to pay for the ride.
Transport fueled by the attention economy? Crazy. But if you wonder how can anyone even imagine that Americans will trade their wheels, their identities, their freedoms for a free ride in a robot world, well, that's just what Silicon Valley does. The tech industry tends toward indifference, bordering on contempt for the status quo and all that preceded it. In a recent New Yorker piece, pioneering autonomous vehicle engineer Anthony Lewandowski was quoted as follows. The only thing that matters is the future. I don't even know why we study history. It's entertaining, I guess, the dinosaurs and the Neanderthals and the Industrial Revolution and stuff like that, but what already happened doesn't really matter. You don't need to know the history to build on what they made. In technology, all that matters is tomorrow.
Oh, this is a quite amazing quotation. I hadn't heard this line before.
Historian Peter Norton.
I wonder what he would think about George Santayana's famous statement that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
For instance, what does the portrait of the self-driving utopia being sold to the American consumer leave out? What does it fail to consider? Norton finds a cautionary historical tale from the Industrial Revolution in Britain, circa 1865.
Their future as a world superpower depended on coal. Most of the experts said, yes, we're using a lot of coal, but our steam engines get significantly more efficient every year. And that means even though we're using a lot of machines and a lot of coal is being burned, we will never actually deplete the supply, at least not within a matter of centuries. Stanley Jevons was a logician, mathematician, economist, all-around genius. And Jevons sat down and did the math, and he realized, actually, the more efficient each engine gets, the more useful applications we find for steam engines. And therefore, even though for each unit of work we'll burn less coal, we're going to be doing more and more stuff with these steam engines, and it will actually end up that we'll consume more, not less, coal every year, and therefore we'll deplete our reserves of coal much more quickly.
This paradox, in which increased efficiency correlates with increased demand, is a manifestation of what economists and planners call induced demand, the phenomenon that causes a new freeway often to increase, not reduce, traffic congestion. We heard some tape earlier from the 1939 World's Fair. Here's a relic from GM's Motorama exhibit in 1956.
We gotta slow down, slow down. So much traffic cuts the flow down.
Till they bring the highways up to date. You can bet your high compression we're gonna be late.
How sad, poor Dad.
Too bad.
We're stuck.
Tough luck.
Yuck, yuck.
Traffic, the solution to which, of course, was more highway. And gee whiz, what do you know? The future highways of the Motorama exhibit featured separate lanes for cars in a self-driving mode.
Here we go on the high-speed safety lane.
Well done, Firebird 2. You're now under automatic control.
Ah, this is the life. Safe, cool, comfortable.
Mind if I smoke a cigar?
Today, the driverless industrial complex is sticking with the congestion-free future story. But wait, there's more. A corollary narrative imagines a boon to cities. Freed of dense downtown traffic and parking shortages, they convert the curbsides to green space and livable cities thrive. Maybe. Or, as Emily Badger suggests, maybe not.
Well, there's also a scenario in which they make it possible for people to live even farther away. Now they're encouraging the consumption of even more rural land and turning it into whatever comes beyond exurbia. But if those unintended consequences will happen, they'll be totally predictable. They're the same unintended consequences that happened when we built the interstate highway system.
Yes, that's history, but only the latest history. Sprawl did not begin with Dwight Eisenhower. Transportation technology has been expanding metropolises since ancient Rome.
If you look at old cities that were built in a time when everyone got around by foot, you know, they're oftentimes about as far across as it would take someone to walk in like half an hour. And then we have these sort of subsequent innovations in transportation, you know, horse-drawn carriages or streetcars, the Model T, interstate highways. Each of these innovations sort of radically changes what it means to commute.
And what it means to belong to a city. Just as streetcars turn the towns immediately surrounding American cities into so-called streetcar suburbs, superhighways flipped forests and farms into bedroom communities and edge cities. Habits changed, housing stock changed, society changed. But whether your home was in the city, a close-in suburb, or former orchard, there was one thing that never much changed. Time.
There is this sort of constant amount of time that we are willing to spend doing this activity.
This subconscious expectation was so universal that the Italian physicist Cesare Marchetti lent it his surname. 30 minutes there and 30 minutes back became the Marchetti constant.
And that remains constant, whatever kind of community you're looking at, if you're looking at Mesa, Arizona, where someone lives in the exurbs, or if you're looking at Washington, D.C., where I ride my bike almost exactly 30 minutes each way. I mean, in the American Community Survey from the Census Bureau, the typical American spends like 26 minutes commuting one way. Obviously, there are people who commute longer than 30 minutes, but I do think that there's something true to the idea that there's a finite amount of this activity that we're willing to put up with.
So when new technologies allow us to cover more distance in the same amount of time, and housing gets less costly with each outward mile, and if self-driving cars do buy you an extra 5 or 10 minutes, how's that urban renaissance beginning to look? What if the autonomous future, quite literally, drives us still farther apart? Peter Norton's book, Fighting Traffic, documents the dawn of the motor age in the U.S., including the years-long battles over who had practical dominion on city streets. It was a decades-long affair fought in courts, editorial pages, and city halls that gave way to unequally divided thoroughfares. Pedestrians here, cars here, and here and here.
When automobiles began crowding city streets in the 19-teens and 20s, the sort of common sense response was, well, we need to restrict the cars. They're getting in the way of the things that do move a lot of people, like streetcars, for example. And they're also injuring and killing pedestrians. Well, we restrict the cars, we slow them down. This was an impediment to people who wanted to sell more cars, not less. And so they quite explicitly said, we have to change what people think streets are for. We have to change them from being for everyone, including people on foot, to being almost exclusively for motor vehicles, except, you know, at certain designated crossing points. One element of that strategy was to ridicule people who kept walking in the streets the way people had always done. They propagated this term jaywalking to ridicule those people.
I'd like to apologize. For getting in your way this morning? I was practically jaywalking.
No, no, you had a perfect right to be standing on the curb.
But I was leaning over.
A century later, those echoes resound.
Uber has suspended all road testing of its self-driving cars after one of the SUVs hit and killed a woman in Tempe.
Tempe, Arizona police say 49-year-old Elaine Herzberg was walking a bicycle across a busy thoroughfare frequented by pedestrians Sunday night. She was not in a crosswalk.
The autonomous vehicle promoters began to explain to us what we need to do about this. One of them said, we just need pedestrians to follow the rules and defer to automobiles more. I think what this well-intentioned statement signifies is the fact that we have forgotten how much we have compelled everyone to conform to systems that assume that driving is the best way for everyone to get around. When you don't know that history, you tend to think, well, this built world around us is a reflection of what we wanted and a reflection of expert judgments. In fact, if you look at the history, you'll find that this world around us is the result of an effort to sell us and sell our governments on the notion that we have to rebuild our world for cars.
I have to push back here. Is it necessarily bad that, for example, pedestrians will have to learn to make accommodations for the benefits that self-driving cars or any other technological advancement may bring us? Isn't that part of the deal in the moving target that is society?
Ideally, technology offers us choices. But I think what you'll find is that often technology takes away choices. If you could have a future where autonomous vehicles make it possible for you to choose to go by vehicle, by foot, by bike, by some other mode, well, that sounds like a very attractive future to me, and I have nothing to find fault with. But what I see in a lot of the visions of the autonomous vehicle future being packaged and sold to us now is a future where those choices, which are already meager, will get worse. Take, for example, the fact that if you're on an autonomous vehicle, you can do your work, you can play games, watch a movie, or sleep. Inevitably, the distances between destinations start to grow. And this means that those people who might have preferred walkable distances, cycling distances, or the densities necessary for efficient and effective transit services will gradually find that those alternatives get fewer, and a kind of car dependency that we already are afflicted with gets worse, and I don't call that progress.
All right, now obviously at this point I'm going to ask you about the Wizard of Oz.
Help me? Can you help me?
You don't need to be helped any longer. You've always had the power to go back to Kansas.
I have.
Then why didn't you tell her before?
Because she wouldn't have believed me. She had to learn it for herself.
So could you save us the whole Yellow Brick Road deal and tell us what we know now and have within our grasp that will save us a bunch of dangerous but predictable errors in our transportation future?
In the book, the Emerald City is a fake. It's made out of white plaster, and it looks like emeralds because you're required to wear green spectacles. And as you look through the green lenses, this plaster city looks like an emerald city. This is a beautiful parable with many possible interpretations, but one of them is that what we thought was so desirable turns out to be an illusion. When we make that realization, that might help us appreciate what we already have, even what we once had but lost, namely cities where if we want a cup of coffee, we can walk two or three blocks instead of getting in a car and going through a drive-thru. Why should we be buying this future and sacrificing a present that works imperfectly for the sake of a future we can't have?
Thing is, it all looks so shiny and enticing and a little bit bizarre. Surreal, you might say, like Oz minus the poppy fields, because you don't need opioids to be lulled into a daydream. Sometimes all you need is too much imagination.
Coming up, an operatic rendering of a titanic clash of visions for the city.
This is On the Media.